I'm Jill Kaufman in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, the People's State of the Union, from jobs for returning vets to concerns about safety in the global economy. But first, the race for the presidency enters a new phase this week as candidates adjust their strategies toward winning the coast-to-coast primaries next week's Super Tuesday. About half of all the delegates to the party conventions will be chosen on that day. On the Democratic side, Barack Obama caps his stunning victory Saturday in South Carolina with an endorsement from Senator Ted Kennedy today. But Hillary Clinton still leads in polls in key states. And on the Republican side, the race remains more fractured than ever, with the leading candidates looking for a strong win tomorrow in Florida to ride into Super Tuesday. So joining us now is Richard Wolff. He's the senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Richard, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good to be back.
The news of the day, obviously, is Senator Kennedy's endorsement of Barack Obama. According to reports, Kennedy had been under a lot of pressure from the Clinton camp to remain neutral. What do you make of the endorsement?
Well, it's huge news, and for a number of reasons. First of all, just in terms of the sort of position Kennedy holds in the party, and the passing of the torch, especially Caroline Kennedy's op-ed in the New York Times, which drew a direct comparison between her father and Senator Obama. But even beyond the sort of emotional level for Democrats, there is a tactical advantage for Obama. It builds on the South Carolina win. Ted Kennedy's a fabulous campaigner and has a strong track record, not just with sort of core working class Democrats, but also Latinos, because of his work on the immigration bill. Two areas where Senator Obama has not fared so well, at least according to the polls. So he's a big tactical win and a sort of a figurative a win as well.
A tactical endorsement as well, though? Would this have happened without Obama's victory in South Carolina this weekend?
You know, he has been working this for a long time, and I think the expectation was it would come at some point. But the timing of this is clearly related to South Carolina. I'm not sure that's a timing based on Senator Kennedy's decision, but it is based, I think it's timed very well for the campaign in terms of building on the momentum of South Carolina.
Well, given all this news from the Barack Obama campaign, is the Clinton campaign reevaluating the tone of their campaign and also Bill Clinton's role? You know, what are some of the lessons maybe that they're taking out of these two major happenings, both the win in South Carolina and the endorsement of the Kennedy family or two members?
Well, I think the Clinton campaign, by its very nature, is constantly reevaluating everything. And we've seen lots of different tones and approaches and strategies coming out of them just over the last few weeks, never mind over the last several months. Now, Senator Clinton has said very clearly that they're going to carry on drawing contrasts between the two candidates. And so I actually don't really think that substantively it's going to change. And I don't think, even in terms of the tone, it's going to change that much. But will there be perhaps less of a focus, less of a prominent role, less frequent appearances, public appearances, by former President Clinton? I think that's probably likely. But again, the Clinton campaign does tend to shift around in terms of its strategy, even in the course of a week.
Let's take a quick look at tomorrow. Florida Republicans are going to the polls tomorrow ahead of Super Tuesday. What are they talking about, and will they produce a front runner?
You know, it will, and that's one aspect of this race. If the polls are right, and of course they've been fabulously wrong several times in this cycle alone, but if they're right, then we're going to see a pretty decisive step for one of either McCain and Romney. That's where Florida has come down to, and I think pretty much the Republican nomination race has come down to. And the second story coming out of Florida is going to be Rudy Giuliani, the man who was until recently the national front runner, staked everything on Florida. And again, if the polls are right, he's heading for a pretty big fall.
Right. And maybe that's it.
And maybe that's it. Although people tend to really drop out when they run out of money. He has, you know, his staff has been running on no money recently, so it doesn't sound like there are many options for him if he loses.
Richard, real briefly, where are the Democrats in Florida? They are on the ballot, but what does a win mean tomorrow?
Well, it doesn't mean anything in terms of delegates. The DNC, the party, has said those delegates will not be seated, but the Clinton campaign is trying to pretend like this is meaningful because they desperately need to stop this momentum that Obama is building out of the South Carolina race. So there's a lot of PR games going on, but in actual fact, these delegates will not be seated.
Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine, thank you very much.
Thank you.
President Bush will deliver his final State of the Union address tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. He's expected to pressure Congress to push through an economic stimulus package quickly. He'll also talk about improved security in Iraq and emphasize to lawmakers that he will decide when U.S. troops come home. Today, we want to get a sense of the State of the Union at the grassroots level. We decided to call people we've spoken to in the past about a wide variety of topics and get their take on the State of the Union 2008. We start in New Orleans, where Cynthia Ceballos works as an immigration lawyer. And Cynthia, President Bush got a lot of flack last year for failing to mention New Orleans in his last State of the Union. But can you start by telling us how things are there today?
Well, Jill, New Orleans has come far. It's almost going to be 3 years this August since Katrina hit, and rebuilding is really booming now. There's a lot of construction going on because most of the families have settled with their insurance company and road home money has come through. So we're seeing a lot of construction in the city, you know, a lot of new buildings, a lot of new roads. It's a great time for New Orleans right now.
New Orleans is sometimes a far ways away from Washington, D.C., but this is the State of the Union tonight. What is the main issue you would like the president to address?
What really surprises me is that, I mean, first the immigration bill didn't pass, but at the same time there's not been, as today, a comprehensive immigration reform. And by that I mean there has to be a realistic visa availability. And H-1B visas, H-2B visas for both skilled and unskilled workers are not sufficient. And in our city, where we basically depend on a lot of construction workers, which are unskilled, companies run out of visas and therefore out of workers.
So temporary work visas, there used to be many more of them pre-9/11. What you'd like to hear tonight from President Bush is a discussion about immigration issues and how it affects how immigration visas affect the economy.
Exactly. We need these workers to fill the positions to keep our economy moving.
What are some of the personal issues that you face in your life that you'd like to hear the president discuss tonight in the State of the Union?
As a young couple, we're suffering with trying to find an affordable place to live in the area that we love, and we're finding it harder and harder now. You've got homes all over for sale. You see one block with three or four homes for sale, so there's a surplus of homes right now. Therefore, the prices are dropping. But even then, when we're able, my husband and I, to find a house, we're being priced out with taxes, which have almost doubled, and insurance, because insurance companies' policies have doubled as well, or they're not insuring at all.
Is Washington paying close enough attention to New Orleans, in your opinion?
I don't think so. And it's tough to see a city with so much history and so much past, especially now that we're going through Mardi Gras and all the other events that we offer the country throughout the year, and to see how there's very little comment about it. I know that people forget, but we cannot forget. We need the support of the president and the country in itself to know that we still need help here. We need those funds to keep coming in quickly because, of course, there's a lot of red tape involved with that. And you know, personally, I'm half Mexican-American, and I'd like to see some more support to the Hispanic community, not only where I live, but all those people who are here illegally who deserve a second chance and a right to be here. I think they've earned it.
Cynthia Ceballos is an immigration lawyer who lives in New Orleans. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you, Jill.
We're now going to hear voices from Virginia and Copland Plantation, Maine. First to Maine, where Matt Tinker is a nature guide. We interviewed him in November, and listeners might remember his unique way of attracting moose so visitors could catch a glimpse of them on his tours. Here's Matt's moose call. Being from rural Maine, where it's about 20 degrees today, the cost of energy is on Matt's mind.
Living in rural Maine, we definitely see the ups and downs. We're very affected by some of the highs and the lows that we see, you know, that some of the folks down in the, you know, more populated areas, let's just say, aren't maybe quite as affected by. Just the price of gas, you never know, going up 20 cents a gallon, you know, it could make a really big difference. So, you know, I'm really kind of interested to see what he may say about the economy, the interest rates dropping, energy concerns that we may have here in Maine. You know, we're seeing a lot of wind power projects coming and go. In the area that I live in, there was a wind power project that was approximately 30 turbines that had been turned down, and there's also been one that's 44 turbines that's been approved by the state. You know, both of these have environmental impacts. Some are a little more visual impacts, and wind power that's moving the economy in Maine has been a great thing, and hopefully some that'll help spur some economic growth in some areas, you know, some of these more rural areas down on the coast and up in the western mountains here. I hope to hear from President Bush how decreases in oil and increase in oil pricing and some increase from the release in our oil reserves may be in for the future, to help relieve some of the pressures of gas pricing, heating oil pricing, things like that that we really see in the Northeast that, definitely affect us that, hopefully the president may speak about.
My name is John Henry Smith, and I'm a farmer from Rosedale, Virginia. The issue I think of main importance is the economy. That's the engine that drives this whole nation. Ethanol has driven the cost of grain in many instances two times, and that coupled with the previous year's drought, it's made it very difficult for beef cattle farmers. I'm not completely convinced that ethanol is the answer. It's kind of marginal in that it takes almost as much energy to produce as you get out of it. I think we need to look at other forms of energy, wind, solar. We need to search for more oil reserves. And as individuals, we need to be more saving in our use of energy because it is a limited commodity.
That was John Henry Smith, a cattle rancher from Rosedale, Virginia. We also heard from Matt Tinker of Maine. Energy and the economy were on their minds, but Jeff Brodeur of Hyannis, Massachusetts, is concerned about the military. Jeff's stepson, Vincent Mannion, suffered traumatic brain injury during a search for insurgents in northern Iraq. He's now recovering at Spalding Rehabilitation Center, a private hospital in Boston. And Jeff, we understand that Vincent has some slow improvement, but it's a long road ahead. So with that weighing on your mind, what would you like to hear the president address tonight?
Oh, well, a couple of issues. One is these poor guys who are doing 3 and 4 tours over in Iraq. I would hope they reduce the tours from 15 to 12 months.
You may have seen in the news last week or otherwise that the U.S. Army is trying to get the tour of duties down to 12 months. Were you aware of that?
I did see that, and when I see it, I'll believe it. And honestly, I really don't think that's fair. There's progress being made. There's a lot less casualties. There's no need for our full troops to be over there at this stage. Also, I'd like to see the president increase health care for the VA for TBI.
TBI being traumatic brain injury.
Correct, correct. One of the reasons we're at Spalding is because nothing in the New England area could help my son up here as far as VA-wise with his injury. The VA, I'm not bashing the VA, but they're not up to par with the private facilities on TBI.
If you were coaching the president, what would you suggest to him? How can he reach out to Americans like yourself?
Honestly, I really don't think the president's going to say much about Iraq or veterans care. It's not on the top of the priority list, I'll be honest with you. The only people who are affected by the war are the families whose sons and daughters are over there. Otherwise, people really don't care. It's just the way it is.
Jeff Brodeur of Hyannis, Massachusetts, thanks for talking with us today.
Sure, thank you.
We're hearing from people around the country and their views on the State of the Union. After a short break, others weigh in on issues from unemployment to lead toys from China. You're listening to Here and Now. Today we're hearing what people around the country think the State of the Union is. Our next guest raised quite a controversy when she was on our show last September. Susan Taylor is a part-time nurse in Bend, Oregon. We spoke to her about Project Laundry List, a movement to hang clothes outside to dry, even in communities where that's banned for aesthetic reasons. Susan says it's her way to fight global warming. Here's Susan with her take on the State of the Union.
We, as Americans, should be absolutely ashamed of what we don't have as far as health care goes. I take care of people every day that my heart just goes out to these people because they have little or no coverage and they have no way of touching the bills when they absolutely need to have health care. And the other thing that is just absolutely huge and is a reflection of what is going on, I think, as far as our standing in the world, is education. What are we doing? We keep slipping further and further behind as far as making that a priority, because unless we are educated and keep ourselves informed, how can we respond to all of the changes that are going on in our world?
That's Susan Taylor from Bend, Oregon. Our next voice comes from Neptune, New Jersey. Naomi Mincy returned from Afghanistan last May. It took her about 8 months to find a job, and she says returning vets face enormous struggles.
I would like to see the president focus more of what's going on here in the U.S. than what's going out there, because we need to take care of our own. The big issue I find important to me is the unemployment. There's a high percentage of unemployment within the state of New Jersey. Going to meetings when I was unemployed, seeing unemployed vets at different age ranges, it's very heartbreaking to see that it's been very tough and struggling for them to find employment, and devastating to see how they served the country for so many years and they were hoping for a better life when they got out. But coming back, there was, like, no jobs within our position of what we learned. We got little jobs of, like, grocery stores and fast food restaurants you find most vets working at. But we were just hoping for something a little bit better. That's all.
That's Naomi Mincy, an Army veteran who now lives in Neptune, New Jersey. Joining us next is Justin Levan. He's an attorney in Des Moines, Iowa, and a leader in Iowa's Christian homeschooling community. We first spoke with him in November, just as Republican Mike Huckabee was rising in the polls. Hello, Justin.
Hello.
What would you like to hear in the president's speech tonight? What's one of your top concerns?
Well, I think we're going to hear about the economy and his stimulus package. That's probably a given. You know, I'd like to hear him to differentiate between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. I think the president, as being the head of the Republican Party with his last final State of the Union address, ought to probably set out the distinction of between the Republicans and the Democrat, being, you know, the election year coming up.
Justin Levan, imagine you were coaching the president before his speech tonight, and you wanted him to go right, you know, right after this topic to differentiate between the two parties. What issues might you push him on? What would differentiate the Republican Party, for instance, from the Democratic Party in the area of trade or that economic stimulus package?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, government spending perhaps may be the biggest issue out there that he probably will address with regard to, you know, I think government spending may be out of control and, you know, where they're going to rein in on that, who's really going to be the fiscal conservatives here so that we can see an actual decrease in taxes versus the increases that we continually see, whether it's been the Democrats in charge or whether it's been Republicans in charge. You know, as far as the trade goes, I'd be extremely interested in hearing him come out with regard to where China's at with our trade relations there. You know, as a father of five children, you know, one of my main concern is the real lack of concern that we've seen with regard to having the lead issues from the toys and the different products that are coming in from China. And it would be great to hear the president at least step up and say what kind of enforcement or role the government's going to take in protecting our children in the United States from lead-based products that may be coming in from China. And if there is issues with lead like we've seen, that they're going to start you know, closing down those products from coming in until China really does prove that their products no longer contain things that are unsafe, such as unsafe lead levels. You know, I just haven't heard that. You know, it seems like we're just taking a blind eye to the products that are coming in and really haven't done anything as far as being able to enforce it.
Justin, I want to take you back for a moment to talk about your concern about spending, government spending.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
When you think about government spending, are you worried in particular where that money is being spent? One of the reasons the government spending has increased so much, as we all know, is because of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan as well. What are your areas of concern in terms of government spending?
Well, I think one of the main areas of concern that I have is the level of the tax increases that we're seeing. In the state of Iowa, where I'm from, there's talk in our legislature of having a permanent sales tax that's going to go just to our school systems. There's talk of, you know, increasing taxes on in every direction they can except for the gas tax. That apparently is dead. You know, we're having issues with taxes in the Midwest. And I think that may be the case nationwide. And, you know, I guess I'd like to hear him talk about, you know, how we can keep more of the money that we're working for and earning as opposed to it going out to the government like it is.
All right, Justin, is there anything else that you'd like to add in terms of what you'd like to hear the president address tonight in his last State of the Union?
Well, you know, on the war in Iraq issue, I think he ought to probably give some real good direction so that people can can know what's happening with that, because I think that's a concern for a lot of folks. Myself, serving in the Army Reserves for 12 years, I always watch that very carefully. I have lots of friends that are either over there or are planning on going back over there again for the second or third time. And I think that, you know, those types of issues are going to have to be addressed.
Justin Levin, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Justin Levin is an attorney and is active in the Christian Homeschool Network in Iowa. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the Florida primary. It's the largest and most diverse state to vote so far. Will voters there winnow down the number of candidates still in the race? Still ahead, great moments from presidential elections past. We look back to the year 2000 and those hanging chads. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Jill Kaufman, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, George Walker Bush, do solemnly swear.
I, George Walker Bush, do solemnly swear.
On January 20th, 2001, George Bush took the oath of office, ending the longest presidential election drama in U.S. history. The 36-day roller coaster ride played out in courtrooms and in the court of public opinion, and the outcome is still being debated today. The 2000 presidential election is one of the great moments in campaign history detailed in the new issue of U.S. News and World Report. Ken Walsh is chief White House correspondent for U.S. News and World Report, and he joins us now. Hello, Ken. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
The roller coaster ride in the 2000 election started as soon as the polls closed in Florida. Can you remind us what happened that night as the night progressed?
What happened was we knew it was going to be very close, and it did seem to be very close. And then as time was going on, I think it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, Al Gore conceded to George W. Bush because Bush had pulled about 50,000 votes ahead. And so a lot of the networks gave Florida's 25 electoral votes to Bush. That seemed to be it after this tremendous roller coaster. But then within 2 hours, Bush's lead started melting away again. The margin went down into the hundreds of votes. So at that point, it triggered an automatic recount under Florida law. And Gore then pulled back his concession. And so we were in this amazing period of charges of voting irregularities and the finding of real voting irregularities, lawsuits, the state legislature getting involved, the Florida Supreme Court, and the issue going all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
You know, when you describe this, I sort of begin to remember my night that night. What about you, Ken Walsh? Where were you and what were you thinking watching this?
Well, I was in our office in Washington trying to write the main story for the magazine on the election. And, of course, when the networks made the call and gave the election to Bush, we figured that, you know, with their exit polling and so on, and with Gore having conceded in particular, it was over. But then the story had to be redone, of course, within about an hour, because it became clear that the lead was changing again, or at least Bush's lead was fading so much that there would have to be a recount. So that threw us all into a tizzy, as it did to everybody who was covering that campaign, as it did to much of the country.
And that's
people
right.
Woke up that morning, we did not have a president who had been elected yet.
You weren't alone among the journalists as well. Here's what it sounded like on CNN.
A big call to make. CNN announces that we call Florida in the Al Gore column. This is a story.
This no longer is a victory for Vice President Gore. We're moving it back
into
the too close to call. George Bush, governor of Texas, will become the 43rd president of the United States at 18 minutes past 2 o'clock Eastern Time. CNN declares that George Walker Bush has won Florida's 25 electoral votes, and this should put him over the top.
So we think. So it began, and that was the beginning of this long drama. You mentioned the lawsuits. There were 47 lawsuits, Ken Walsh, related to the election that were filed in Florida. Can you break them down and explain what the problems were, what the voting irregularities were?
Sure. Well, what happened was it became clear that many of the hand-marked ballots were defective or hard to read. In Florida, at that time, they had these little cards that many people around the country have voted on, where you punched through to make your vote. Some people had not punched through completely. you had what they called chads, which were little pieces of paper where the punch was supposed to have gone through, and this famous phrase, hanging chads, became part of our lexicon for that more than month period, because that meant that one of the chads, the little pieces of paper, were hanging off, and it was unclear absolutely what the intention of the voter was. Both sides, the Gore team and the Bush team, flooded Florida with lawyers. And I remember a lot of the people who I knew in politics who also happened to be lawyers, and that's a lot of people, were all being called down there county by county to try to protect the one candidate or the other. And then the issue focused on the idea of a manual recount.
That was another lexicon entry. He became a person in my mind. Every time I wrote it, it's Emmanuel recount.
Right, exactly. You know? And the Gore people felt that in a number of counties where he should have won, Palm Beach, Broward, Miami-Dade, and Volusia, that if they counted the votes again, they would find more votes for Al Gore. So what everybody started to do is to, county by county, go through the courts to force recounts. And so that was starting to happen. And the Bush team, since at that moment he was ahead, wanted to block the recounts, thinking that that might change the result. And they had the argument that the state Supreme Court had exceeded its authority in ordering the recount. But on November 24th, now, you know, this is 3 weeks after the election, we still don't know who our president is, and the U.S. Supreme Court agrees to hear Bush's appeal of the Florida decision in their Supreme Court that allowed the hand recounts to proceed. So where we are there is, will the hand recounts proceed? And if they do, a lot of people felt that Gore would win. Then on November 26th, Florida Secretary of State Katherine Harris, who it turned out was the state chairman for the Bush campaign, certified the results for the state that gave Bush a 537-vote lead, an incredibly small margin. But then, meantime, the Al Gore Democratic team won a court hearing to challenge those totals. Meanwhile, the hand recount, we remember those pictures of people, mm-hmm. these election officials holding up these cards to see if they can discern what the voter intent was, and going over one ballot in a very painstaking effort, one ballot after another, sometimes using magnifying glasses, trying to discern the intent of voters who thought they had made their intent clear on Election Day.
So finally, on December 12th, the Supreme Court made its decision, allowing the official Florida vote tally to stand, and the next day, Gore conceded.
While I strongly disagree with the court's decision, I accept it. And tonight, for the sake of our unity as a people and the strength of our democracy, I offer my concession.
Ken Wallace, do you think the voters in Florida, when they go to the polls in the primary tomorrow, are going to be thinking about 2001? It's a completely different electoral, it's a completely different voting system. It's electronic. But
right.
What do you think?
Well, I think that, people tend to move on, and that's been a long time, especially in political time. 7 years ago, more than 7 years ago now, and we are headed for another what seems to be a photo finish here. And whenever you get close elections now, a lot of people start to wonder about the count. So I think to the extent that this is very close tomorrow in the Republican primary, a lot of Floridians will be reminded, particularly if there's any glitch at all. If there's long lines, they'll start to think, well, here we go again.
Ken Walsh is Chief White House Correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. Thank you, Ken Walsh, for joining us today.
Thank you.
To link to the magazine's great moments in campaign history, you can visit our website, here-now.org. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll check the latest voting technology and we'll talk about the importance of the Florida primary. Just a reminder, you can listen to today's show stream live on our website. It's here-now.org. For past programs, click on the archives, and you can download a podcast and take us with you wherever you go. That's here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Next month, the Bush administration is expected to announce whether it will list the polar bear as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, threatened by global warming, as rising Arctic temperatures continue to reduce the bear's habitat and food supplies. If listed, it will be the first time a species is included because of global warming, so there's been an intense lobbying effort underway in Washington, D.C. on the bear's behalf. And as Here and Now's Jill Ryan discovered, even some bears have gotten into the act.
It's a rainy night in Washington, D.C., and while there are no polar bears at the National Zoo here, a few blocks away in a dingy basement storefront beneath a barber shop, a muffled voice speaks from behind a furry white mask.
I'm kind of like a refugee. I don't have a place to live. And so we were here on the streets. We're on Capitol Hill. We're kind of invading human territory because we don't have territory, and we are eating humans.
That's Adam Eitinger. He leads an environmental group called Polar Bears for Solutions to War and Global Warming. It's a new group, and its members spend their days demonstrating at banks or at the Capitol building. You may have seen them on TV. Anytime there's a climate change protest, there they are, dancing, singing, or stripping down to their skivvies like they did recently on Capitol Hill.
Okay, it's a polar bear bikini party. What this means is you get to cool off. Because the polar bears, if they can't cool off in Washington, D.C., they're going to have to get naked.
They didn't actually undress, but they got the point across. Polar bears don't like warm weather. The activists also take this message through city streets or on public transit, all while wearing their chunky fur suits.
It's funny, you wear a polar bear costume, hey, that's about global warming. Everyone knows as soon as they see it.
And for all its simplicity, the costume elicits a childlike fascination among those who cross the bear's paths.
But when you're dressed as a polar bear, everybody wants to hug you, everyone wants to touch you. People get really excited about the polar bear.
But just who are these faux bears? Well, under heaps of fur, you'll find regular people with regular day jobs. There's a graphic artist, a video documentarian, and a mom and dad. They've come to Washington to make the case for conservation, renewable fuels, and an end to the war in Iraq. But tonight's not about dressing up and chanting, it's about breeding. Polar bear costumes, that is. One bear-to-be sits at a small table and rips apart paper grocery bags. He drops the little brown bits into a bowl filled with a cornstarch water solution. Ariel Vigosin takes the paper bits and spreads them over a clay mold to form the face of a mask. She says the costumes are a creative way to address the mammal's precarious situation.
Polar bears are some of the, you know, first to feel the effects of global warming. Like, our homes are getting destroyed. We have to swim more than ever. Our food supply is diminishing. The ice around us is diminishing. So we're the first to face this. So we had to come out here and tell people, but a couple years from now, there's going to be more than just polar bears.
Across the room, Wendy Lehman sits covered in a blanket of fluffy synthetic fur.
I'm cutting out a pattern for a polar bear suit. I think this is footies.
At a nearby table, Adam Eitinger sews together Lehman's cutouts.
Okay, let me get my safety pins ready because we'll need those.
Eitinger says the costumes are a pain to make. It took the group an entire day to put together the first. But that doesn't seem to faze any of the activists. They know the suits are crucial to the polar bear character.
You know, when you're the polar bear, you're the polar bear. And nothing else. And you can really get into the identity of the polar bear. And you have this fun. It's like acting. It's a lot of fun. I've done the knocking on doors thing for a lot of different causes over the years. But I still prefer to go somewhere and create a spectacle and then have people want to talk to me, you know, want to be involved.
And that's the polar bear's purpose, to keep climate change on our minds, to urge people to consume less, recycle more, and use renewable energy. And if a shouting activist clad in flowing white fur doesn't catch your attention, maybe a handful of them rapping will.
And then recycle and reuse, conservation first. Then.
Here and Now's Jill Ryan with the rapping polar bears of Washington, D.C. Coming up, a high school basketball coach who says getting his players to college is just as important as winning championships. Here and Now. Boston's Charlestown High School was a major focus of conflict in the 1970s when court-ordered busing brought African-American students to the primarily white neighborhood. The move faced resistance from both sides. Decades later, the struggle has changed. Now the fight is to get students at the Charlestown High School to graduate and go on to college. Boys basketball coach Jack O'Brien has made that his mission. O'Brien has led Charlestown to 5 state championships, and he's also become a father figure who's devoted his life to the welfare of his players both on and off the court. Author Neil Swidey profiles O'Brien in a new book, The Assist, Hoops, Hope, and the Game of Their Lives. Neil Swidey spoke to Bill Littlefield, host of the NPR show Only a Game, about Coach O'Brien.
The team you followed during the 2004-2005 season was, of course, exceptionally successful on the court. But the first thing Jack O'Brien said to the seniors on the team after their final game was, "You should be proud of yourselves. You're all going to college." How unusual is that attitude among high school coaches?
I think that's not common enough. And I think what O'Brien realizes is that winning is a means to an end. He loves to win. It kills him when they lose. But people on the outside sort of look at him and say, oh, he must really only care about winning. But what you see is he realizes winning is the way to get these guys connected, sort of building success in their lives, but that it really ends, and it ends poorly unless there's a next step, and that step is college for inner city kids.
Perhaps the most triumphant member of the team on and off the court is a fellow named Ridley Johnson. Tell me a little bit about his game.
Well, Ridley is a fascinating guy. He's so level-headed. He's so easygoing. Around school, around Charlestown High School, the teachers would always say, anytime I asked him about that, oh, that Ridley, he's the nicest kid. It was almost like a handle he had. And I think he used that to his benefit. O'Brien would go after him on the court and say, we love you being so nice off the court, but on the court, that's not going to get you anywhere. So he was a kid that was more comfortable on the perimeter. He had a beautiful jump shot, great vertical leap, but had to be pushed to kind of get inside and get scrappy.
Another of the players whom you follow very closely is Jason White, whose nickname is Hood. He has an earring, a gold earring that spells out Hood in one ear. He heads off to Adelphi University on Long Island for a number of reasons that didn't work out.
This is one of the things that I came to realize that I didn't know going into this is just the narrow margins for these kids just getting to school each day. Most of these kids are spending 3 hours crossing subway lines and buses just to get to high school.
This is for Charlestown High, and some of them can't go through shortcuts because they'd go through neighborhoods that would be dangerous for them because of the projects they live in and,
exactly.
and rivalries and that sort of
thing. Exactly, and that dawned on me when I actually made the commutes. I would get up at 4:30 in the morning I wanted to sort of live the life that they were living, mostly off the court, because that was really the fascinating period. And that was stunning, just to be able to say, well, there's a subway station right across the street from your project. Why can't you take that? And just sort of matter-of-factly understanding these lines that were invisible to me but were unmistakable to them, I can't go there.
Yeah.
And just the easy way they do that. So you get through this whole minefield of distractions and setbacks to get to college. But once you get there, it's amazing how quickly things can go wrong.
In Hood's case, Jason White's case, one thing that went wrong is he kept leaving Adelphi to come back to Charlestown. It was almost like he was homesick and couldn't stand to be away. And then the other, he got caught up in a crime. I mean, there was a gun involved. He dropped a big piece of paving stone through somebody's windshield and ended up doing time in jail.
Yeah, and if you look at that, again, if you separate out some of the extenuating circumstances you just mentioned and just say, what actually was the crime here? The crime was busting a windshield, which, again, was a crime and it should have never happened. But if you look at that and say, how many average suburban athletes would their life pivot on a busted windshield? You can't sort of think of that, but you think it here and you think, well, he's in a place, he's hanging around with his cousin who had a record. All automatically that sort of pivots it to a more serious situation. It goes to a special court session that's supposed to get guns off the street, and all of a sudden this very minor case, by the way, which he was acquitted of any kind of gun possession or any issue on that, does have this outsized effect in his life.
It's hard to imagine that any coach could be more successful than Jack O'Brien was, but after the 2005-2006 basketball season, and this is where it gets a little weird, he quit. Why?
O'Brien works best when he's kind of pushing that rock up the hill and sort of under siege a little bit, getting the players to sort of think, that they're not being appreciated in what they have to move for, that their bonds are the most important bonds, and those sort of close out the noise around them and the distractions. But what you had is, after all this success and all this effort, there were a couple of instances where O'Brien really wasn't appreciated by the community around him, the bureaucracy that within which he works, and that adds up. And then all of a sudden he's being courted by other school systems saying, you do what you do here and we're going to protect you and we're going to give you the wherewithal to do it and just do your job because we want you to do what you do best. And so he goes for that. But I think what you see in there is O'Brien has a hard time leaving because it's not just another job. He can't. And when people look at it, they say, well, what's going on? Because, you know, as you see, he leaves and then comes back and then leaves. And and people are thinking, is he having a nervous breakdown?
That's exactly what it sounds like. He decides to leave Charlestown. He's offered what looks to be a better job. At the last minute, he says, no, I can't go. And he goes back to the principal at Charlestown, says, I want to stay. By then, the job is gone. His assistant has taken it. So he's a kind of a gym teacher at Charlestown. He does sound like a guy who's having a nervous breakdown, or at least a guy who can't make up his mind.
And I think you look at it from a distance, but I think when you see it, and when I was sort of with him and with the players, one, you see the reaction of kids crying in the halls, kids breaking down in the cafeteria because he was leaving. And he sort of thought it was time. It was ready. They could handle it. He had built this in place. He had an assistant who would take over. And he realized that he couldn't do that. And when I knew that it was not going to work out, that he was not going to be able to leave, which was, I went to one alumni game the previous year, which was this jubilant experience. The next year, right after he had announced he was leaving, it was a confusing sort of forlorn experience. Mm. And he had the alumni coming back and saying, we'll go to battle for this guy. He's done so much for us. Whatever is going to be better for him, we support, but we don't understand it. They were coming back to a school. Their identity was through O'Brien. It wasn't to Charlestown High School. So they were confused about what happens, this big part of their lives, what happens when he's gone. And I think he couldn't ultimately reconcile himself with that, and so that's why he ended up staying.
Have you had any reaction from any of these players or from Jack O'Brien? Because this is a very candid book. I mean, you talk about some of the things that have gone wrong in the lives of the players and the coach as well as some of the things that have gone very right. Have any of them gotten back to you on
this? Yeah, absolutely. I've stayed connected with pretty much all of them. In fact, we just had a kind of party where we got together. Instead of doing a traditional book launch party, we got the families together of the people in the book. And it was a wonderful experience. And basically, they understand. I was clear as I was going along with them on this. These are real lives, and I didn't want to have surprises for people, so I tried to prepare them along the way, but that there's dignity in their stories, and that I had to kind of follow the story where it went. And they were okay with that. I mean, it was amazing how at ease with sort of difficult chapters in their lives because they understand the larger point. They understand of the success in overcoming that, and they understand what they've done. And I told them, I can't change what happens. I got to follow the story where it goes. But I never stopped hoping that it would work out well for each of them.